This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Friday, December 2nd edition of the DRF Players Podcast, show number 193, if I have my calculations correct. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you alongside the usual crew we have from the DRF offices in New York, Mr. Mike Hogan.
Hello.
And we have calling in from the planet Texas, as always, Jonathan Kinchin. JK, what's your story?
Yeah, apparently I'm going to be moving to the Bowery in New York, begging for coffee money. I don't know what that means. You guys are going to have to help me out.
We got to talk about that. The Bowery, you don't have to add that extra syllable, really. I'd just say Bowery. Famously, back in the day, you know, the Bowery bums, it was people down on their luck. You might see them on the Bowery hanging out in the street there. These days, you're probably more likely to find an $800 handbag on the Bowery than you are an actual homeless person. But was this some sort of Twitter? You in another one of your famous Twitter wars, JK?
No, I don't. I'm not going to war with this one. It's just some guy asked me like what to look at in replays, and I tweeted at him to look for trouble, look for horses that are with or against the race flow. Like we talked about on Tuesday, if the three horses that were on the lead in the first call are still on the lead at the end, then it was a race flow that kind of held up. So horses that were closing into that were in trouble. So, and then I also talked about gallop outs, which I think are important. And somebody decided that that wasn't the case and that I was going to end up begging on the corner, betting off of gallop outs, which I couldn't disagree with more. I mean, you know, I think there's a lot to gallop outs, and we can.
Oh, absolutely. I wrote a piece actually. I think it was the way I became friends with a friend of the podcast and listener Ed DeRosa. We did a piece. Maybe I'll dig it up and tweet it. I wonder if I'm allowed to do that now that I'm a DRF employee. And this was a piece I wrote for a rival ADW back in the day where Ed DeRosa is associated with. I'm sure everyone listening knows the one I'm referring to at this point. But it was really fun. It was a cool idea he had of doing this debate series on his ADW blog that I was a regular participant to for a while. And that was the question. It was, are gallop outs important? I took the yes, he took the no, and I was pretty happy with my argument. I mean, I don't, here's the thing about gallop outs. I mean, and it's funny, Jonathan, because I think it relates to what you were just saying about race flow. I sometimes think a gallop out can be deceiving. I certainly wouldn't bet on the gallop out alone. But boy, what an important piece of information for me, especially with young horses trying to ascertain whether they have more in the tank, whether they want to run longer, whether maybe a green two-year-old is finally figuring things out, running down the lane, and is clearly enjoying their job past the wire. I think there's a lot of valuable information you can get from that. And you know, obviously, it's not the – I think – any one handicapping factor, when used in isolation, it's going to be a little bit tricky. Gallop outs maybe higher on that list of things you wouldn't want to look at in isolation than something like speed figures. But it's a little weird to me to say they don't matter at all. And I encourage your Twitter troll to bet more money in the pools. Mike, yeah. What do you think?
You know, I think gallop outs, they're like a lot of things in racing. A lot of times they don't matter at all until the times that they do. And that's the key, is identifying when something is worth acting upon and when it's just so much more noise. And I think you mentioned some of the examples that make sense. You've got a horse that maybe is bred to go longer, is sprinting first or second start, is stretching out. You know, what they do in the gallop out or what the jockey has been asked by the trainer to do in the gallop out is often useful information. Compare that to, say, California Chrome in the Pacific Classic. It doesn't matter to me whether he gallops out, you know. And sometimes it can be very useful. Other times it can be a red herring that distracts you from really what's more important.
I think the basic idea in handicapping, put the gallop out aside. I think that handicapping as a whole, identifying which horses are the best, I think that and who has the best chance of winning, is identifying energy distribution and how it happens in a race. That's, to me, that's the scientific answer for pace makes the race, right? It's energy distribution between point A and point B. And when a horse shows great energy at the end of the race, that tells me that the energy distributed within the race was not efficiently used in order for him to win that day, but that there was more energy there to be had. And so you can expect a better performance moving forward. I mean, how you can argue with that, it's kind of like arguing with Mike about Songbird being 8%. I don't know how to do it.
I had to go there, Jonathan. We were weren't going to give Mike a hard time about that anymore. Mike, you have to bring it up.
Mike took a subtle shot at me earlier, so it was just payback. He reminded me that I said that Flincher wasn't going to lose another race in North America.
Yeah, but not on the air, which should actually lead into why I mentioned that. This is the dawning of a new era in the DRF Players podcast that maybe not everybody realizes, but we've got a mixer now, which allows us to do a lot more, such as bring back audio clips from previous shows. And one of the things I mentioned before you joined pre-call, Pete, was I could dig up that old clip of Jonathan saying, Flincher will not lose another turf race in North America in 2016, and I can play that back.
And then we could play the stretch call of the race at Belmont and the Breeders' Cup. Boom. We'll get all this stuff in there.
Yes.
I know. Do you have the one little piece of pre-produced audio you've done? Do you happen to have it ready? I thought we could play it perhaps one last time. While we're giving Jonathan a hard time, we could play that piece of audio that you've created in honor of Not This Time, the recent retiree, who Jonathan now has a... it was looking very good, that 100-1 future bet. Not looking so... Or was it even more than 100-1 you had on him?
No, it was 100-1.
100-1. I thought it may be in honor of that horse, Mike, you could play this very cool clip that you've come up with.
Well, yeah, and I think eventually we'll create a number of segments and we'll have tournament talk or whatever. You know, it's the nice thing is we can have fun with this, but this was an idea I had for a segment that we call Greatest Horse Ever. You know, and you hear it all the time. Somebody runs a huge race, Frosted's Met Mile, wow, greatest horse, you know. And so then the next week there's somebody else that runs an amazing race. Arrogant is the fastest horse. And so I wanted a segment that was kind of fun, kind of tongue-in-cheek, that maybe has a big voiceover, greatest horse ever, and then has this clip play.
One of the greatest performances you'll ever see. How much the best is he?
He is running like a tremendous machine.
Going to dominate the field and horrify him here.
Complete one act of fear and really humiliates rivals.
Fab sitting work. Impromptu contest. If someone can correctly identify each of the clips in the segment that Mike just paid, tell us the horse that those were for. I will send a free copy of my book, Winning Contest Player, to someone who... Email that correct answer to podcast@drf.com. So if you want a free copy of the Winning Contest Player, go ahead and do that.
That's a fine game, but I can guarantee there's one call in there that no one will get. I'll just put it that way. So
saved me books, Mike. Then they have to pay for them, and I get a good guy for making the offer. I'm glad you mentioned the mixer. I had a whole thing, Mike, I was going to do this whole spiel about how, you know, Christmas in a few weeks, but Christmas for Mike Hogan came early in the form of this mixer that I know I've been excited about, but I think you've even been more excited about. And I was going to ask you how it compared to, you know, receiving the cherry red tricycle on your third birthday.
I don't know. I mean, I think Christmas these days is much more exciting for a 3-year-old than it is for a 45-year-old. We'll put it that way. I'm just glad that I get to experience it as a 3-year-old through the eyes of my son now.
Yeah, we have a lot of toddler holiday activity. We'll have to do some sort of Christmas special as we get closer to the show, and perhaps do some gift exchanging ourselves through the magic of radio here on the DRF Players podcast. We're eventually during the show going to be getting to talk about the racing this weekend. We've got a Grade One at Hollywood Park. We've got the Claiming Crown races, which look terrific. We're going to do a little bit of tournament talk. I also have some questions from the audience. Maybe we'll turn to those next. Mike, I realize it's funny that because of this mixer, this is the first time I'm not running Spreaker, and I realize one of the funny effects of that is I don't know, I don't have a clock of the show in front of me. So just tell me now, and then I'll make a note of it. How long have we been on the air for?
10 minutes and 20 seconds. So we started a little bit later.
Yeah. Right. We'll go right to noon. I have an important appointment I have to get to. But all right, that's good. So I will plan. I will plan things out according to that. Should mention to folks that the Spreaker thing is happening, and we thank the people who've been listening via Spreaker and checking out these shows live. I think we finally got a schedule, right, Mike?
We do. We're now going to be 11 a.m. Eastern time, Tuesdays and Fridays. So lock it in. And going forward, too, the mixer allows us to actually go live on Facebook, on drf.com. So we'll be doing that. You can find us the same places you always do, after the fact downloads, YouTube, SoundCloud, iTunes, whatnot. You could listen live at Spreaker as well. None of that will change. It just allows us to add on different distribution channels. So it's fun.
That reminds me, I should probably tweet the live link of this show right now. Yeah, there it is. You sent it out, Mike, through your account this time, and we'll send that. Maybe we'll get a few more listeners that way. You can also ask questions during the show if we have time. Not sure we're going to have time today, but we can always save them for future shows. You can submit them right through Spreaker. You can find that through Spreaker itself or by following any of us on Twitter. Okay, that out of the way, let's get to these two questions I had during the week. One, you know, we could spend an hour on, but we're going to give the quick version of the answer. One of our listeners wanted us to have a discussion about class and how class affects our handicapping. Jonathan, I'll start with you. It's not something you and I have ever talked about even, so I don't know if you look at it at all. Is class something that's important when you're trying to pick winners in horse races?
Yeah, no, it is for sure. My view on it, though, is that it's fairly relatable to speed figures. So it's like anything, you know, to me, class is, you know, a mid-level race in America, to me, would have a speed figure of, you know, between 60 and 75. So to me, that's class enough. The class that you're looking for is a horse who's dropping in off of an 80. The only thing that matters to me in those scenarios is that a horse that is running against better horses that is a speed horse, I can give them a kind of a free pass for having a lower figure because they're being buried early by a horse who's better than them. A horse that's closing into a fast pace, I still feel like they should run their best number in those situations because they're not being – I mean, they're chasing good horses, but they should still kind of run their same number. I think that horses that are getting buried by other kind of speed horses, you know, they have more of an excuse to run a lower number. But I kind of let the figure kind of do the class work for me. And then just some basic ideas, you know, dropping in from a grade one to a grade two is obvious. There's obvious differences there. Maybe even a grade three would be a better example.
Yeah, that's you're getting to an idea famously espoused by Len Ragazin that class is speed. And while I think that's maybe 80% of the equation for me, the way I look at the world, I do think there are some instances where I do utilize certain aspects of class handicapping a little bit more than that. There's also very much of an interrelationship between all the fundamental handicapping factors when it comes to class. There's ways that it relates to pace, as Jonathan was saying, to speed, to form. That are much too involved of a discussion to have here, but I definitely recommend checking out Jim Quinn's book that I had the pleasure of editing, The Complete Handicapper, for a really full discussion of the ways that those factors interrelate to each other. And then just in terms of a definition, and maybe the question was even more basic than I read it to you guys about what class is, and I would just describe it as the level at which a horse was born to compete. And in that sense, and I quoted, I don't know which football announcer it was when I was researching, not the winning contest player, but Six Secrets of Successful Bettors, had this quote that I loved about how form is fickle, but class is permanent. And I like that idea. I just wanted to throw that out there. Mike, how about you? Any thoughts on class?
Yeah, and it's a great question to ask on the claiming crown day, where you have to read conditions quite closely, and a lot of times horses fit conditions a long way back in their PPs and are dropping in for much tougher races versus others that maybe ran for the tag that allowed them to meet the condition in their last start and are moving up to face these other horses. That is the exact way I use class in certain races, because look, it's a lot easier to beat a field when you're running against cheaper horses than it is against much, much better horses. Speed figures aside, it's easier to run a big speed figure when you're facing horses that generally don't run very fast. So that's one of the ways I look at it. The other way I look at it, and it's kind of something that you mentioned, Pete, about what classes horses are born to run at. I look to trainers sometimes, and there was an example yesterday at Aqueduct. I don't know if either of you were watching Aqueduct, but in the sixth race yesterday, you guys following?
Were Jonathan and I watching Aqueduct? Who do you think you're dealing? Of course, okay. You're watching Aqueduct. We're sick.
Right. Do you remember what I'm talking about when I say the sixth race yesterday? It was a two-year-old maiden special weight on the dirt, 6 furlongs. And I believe the favorite, it was for most of the race, and I'm looking at the chart now. Yes, he was the post-time favorite, 5-2, was a Todd Pletcher runner making his second career start. Okay? You remember this horse? Driven by Thunder.
Never mind. I had the wrong horse's head in my head. Yeah. But keep going.
Driven by Thunder. So was coming off of a second place finish in the debut at maiden 50, I think. And my feeling with especially Todd Pletcher horses, Bob Baffert too, these top trainers, certain ones have a history. And I can pretty much rely on Todd Pletcher debuting a two-year-old in a maiden claimer. That horse is probably maiden claiming quality. And sure enough, that horse was never a threat and ended up beating one horse in the field as your favorite. That's where I look at class sometimes. Speed figure wise, he absolutely fit against the others coming from maiden special weight company, or, you know, as actually won by a first time starter. But I look at it from that standpoint. When Todd Pletcher tells me that he's got a maiden claimer, I usually take that to heart.
Yeah, you're not going to be that interested in betting him in a maiden special weight, even a weaker one toward the end of the year. I think that's a good example. We had another question. This is one we've tackled on the show before, so I don't think we need to spend a ton of time on it again, but we'll let Mike kick off with this one. Somebody was asking about the importance of rail settings on the turf and how they affect your handicapping. Mike, go.
Oh, this is another one that's perfect for Gulfstream, because Gulfstream essentially has two – they have one turf course, but the way they move their rail settings, they set it up as if they have sometimes two or even three different settings. There's with the rails down, the temporary rail down, rail at zero, they will go out up to 110, 118 feet in some instances. And you think about – I guess the analogy you can use is a four-lane highway that has two of the lanes closed off, okay? Even if there's not as much traffic, sometimes if you're trying to get by slower cars, there's not as much space to do so. So it is often more difficult for these closers, or at least my experience shows that it's different for a lot of these off-the-pace closers to get good trips when the rails are out really far. At certain tracks, when they don't really move the rails, it doesn't really matter so much. But Gulfstream is an example where you absolutely want to pay attention to where the rails are on the current day that you're handicapping and where they were in previous races.
My clue on that, my two cents is that while I agree in theory it should matter a lot at a place like Gulfstream, the one guy I know who studied this statistically, Jake Jacobs from Racing Flow, the tidbit he pointed out to me was that he really saw the statistical difference in rail settings when the oval was already tight to begin with. And the two courses I remember him mentioning specifically were Belmont's Inner and Saratoga's Inner, that when the rail settings are out there, it's really noticeable that the speed horses do better than the closers. JK, how about you? In your experience, does that old saw hold true about rail out equals speed? And any other thoughts you have quickly on rail settings? Out there, it's really noticeable that the speed horse. What was that?
Yeah, that was, I was like, Peter, are you asking another question?
Yeah, no, that was.
Sorry. I was messing with something I shouldn't have. This is the downside of having the mixers. You guys can hear everything going on.
Practicing. He's practicing. You know what's funny is I have struggled. I've asked a lot of good handicappers. I've probably asked you before, Pete. I know I've asked Duke before. I'm like, look, man, I get a lot of stuff in life. I don't really get this rail thing. Can you explain it to me? So when the rail is out, they do what? I really honestly don't have a strong opinion about it. But what I will tell you is this. I do pay attention to when the rail has been out for a longer period of time and it comes down. I feel like the inside grass is obviously better.
Yes.
The outside lanes have been chewed up, and it's harder to run on that part of the grass than it is on the other part of the grass. So that's the only way that I really – that's the only time I kind of pay attention to it.
Belmont Day from this past year comes to mind. I thought the inside on the turf was really good and maybe flattered some horses who were running on the inside that day just a little bit. And it made me at the time think that maybe Flincher really would not lose another turf race in North America because he came so wide and I thought was on the worst part. So sometimes these little tidbits help you in your handicapping. Other times they hurt you. But I think that's a good little overview for our listener who asked that question. Couple more things I want to get to before we talk about the races. Let's go ahead and talk tournaments. Some interesting stuff going on this weekend, especially in Florida at Gulfstream Park. We've got the Conquer the Crown contest. Boy, looking at these races, JK, as a contest player, now I know you're not planning on going to Florida, but when you look at these races and look at what the pool sizes have been on Claiming Crown Day the last couple of years, are you tempted to get the jet fired up and go down to Gulfstream and hang out with the guys and gals who are going to be competing in that contest?
It's tempting. It was my, I think it was, feels like it was the site of my last tournament win. So I would like to get there and defend my crown, but I'm going to leave that to my buddy Jack Jenkins and Nick Tamaro to try to get down there. Or maybe I think Blake Jesse's going as well. So, yeah, no, it looks like it's going to be a ton of fun. I'll be involved from a distance. I can promise you that.
It's a pretty interesting deal. And anybody listening who has the chance to get down there, entries are open. You can contact Nancy Berry. If you look for my preview article on DRF.com, I give her phone number and her email. Or you can just show up at the Sport of Kings on Saturday. I'd bring cash. I'm not sure if they can process a card on day of, but it's really pretty much the ideal day, other than Breeders' Cup, to me, to have a live bankroll contest where you're going to be able to make these big bets, hopefully not have them affect the pools too much, though there are daily doubles in the contest. That pool might be smaller, so maybe I shouldn't speak so quickly about pools being so big that you can bet whatever you want, but it should be a really cool day, and it should be a great contest. Looking forward to that. Other big news in the contest world, DRF's exclusive window of NHC qualification has begun. So we're going to have, from now until the NHC in late January, going to be having two contests per weekend. And it's kind of cool. Players can choose what's important to them. You can either play for a lower price point, $162 is the contest on Sunday, where one in 70 entries will win the grand prize, which includes not only an NHC berth and a shot at your share of $2.5 million, but also a four-night stay at Treasure Island at $1,000 in travel. So you, for $162, you're 1 in 70 for that. Or you can play on Saturday where you'll put up $300, I believe it is, for a 1 in 30 ratio. JK, which of those two contests are you more interested in, or would you be playing in both where you're not double qualified?
The one where you pay more, I prefer those. When you play in the lower ones, it's my opinion. The frustrating things that can come from tournaments. There's a couple of frustrating things. There's 117 great things. The couple of frustrating things, one of them is that these senseless horses that you just, no matter how many times you look at the race, you can't come up with. Those seem to affect me more in the larger pooled tournaments because there's more people that are going to have them. That's more people to try to catch. I just feel comfortable in smaller tournaments with bigger buy-ins. That's just my comfort zone.
I knew you were going to say that. And also very important to point out this year, not only more tournaments during the exclusive qualifying period, but for the first time in this exclusive qualifying period, we got feeders on DRF. So from Wednesday to Sunday, there will be feeders as low as $18. Many of them will be top 10% already by, that means, you know, a 1 in 10 ratio, obviously. The annoying things Jonathan's talking about that sometimes happen, much less likely to happen when it's 1 in 10 people getting to their goal. And there's some talk that Ken Kirchner and the brass at DRF tournaments are going to be adding a top 20% feeder into these qualifying events. I have to say, if you're chasing tour points, if you're one of the people like a friend of the podcast, Eric Bylick, who is looking to just get his NHC seat via tour points, I think he should be playing in all of these, especially those 20% ones as they come up. Also, people looking to inch up into the top 40 for a shot at that extra 25,000, like you, Jonathan, I think you should be playing in all these feeders. So tell me, did my sales pitch work? Will we see your name in those next week?
Yeah, you know, I think for what most people can do is the risk reward for me at this point, being double qualified, to spend a lot of money trying to get into the top 40 doesn't seem like the smartest investment. But what is a smart investment and what I will be doing is I will be playing in every cheap feeder Wednesday through Friday to try to earn my way into the Saturday, Sunday stuff. So essentially I can get in for 18 or 20 or 30 bucks rather than having to pony up the whole 100 and whatever. And then that, I'll let that kind of determine my fate. If I can do well during the week, then I'll play on the weekend. Now, if you weren't qualified and you've never been to the NHC, you know, I think that spending, if it fits your budget, spending a couple $100,000 to try to get qualified, it's worth it. It's an unbelievable trip. It's so much fun. Just sitting down in the bars of the Treasure Island on the night before, and there's literally 45 to 100 people around you that literally care about the exact same things you do, and your random bar conversation is not about baseball or politics, for crying out loud. You're talking about the 7th at Gulfstream, and it's a lot of fun. It really is a ton of fun.
It's a great point, JK. I call it the best horse player party of the year, and I really believe that. It's like a sort of a convention feeling, but better than that, because everybody there has won their way there, and I think for a lot of players, just getting there is their annual goal as a horse player. And I think that creates some seriously good vibes, that there are, you know, there's a lot of people who are happy to be there. And even the ones who have bigger goals, such as yourself, there's still this reward aspect to be in the hunt. And it's a cool vibe. And it's something every horse player, I believe, should try to experience at least once. And this is a great way to get involved for very little money. So folks should definitely check out tournaments.drf.com, the DRF Tournaments website, and look to get involved. Gentlemen, I've committed a hosting faux pas because I do want to talk about this graded stakes stuff, but then I also have the perfect tournament-related segue to talking about these races today. So we're going to hit the pause button, not literally, Mike, but we're going to hit the pause button on the tournament talk portion of the show. We're going to talk quickly about the graded stakes stuff, and then we're going to come back to tournaments, and then we'll do these races, and we're going to do it all in 30 minutes. I don't have a ton to say about this graded stakes stuff. I'll give you my deal first. The graded stakes committee, I suppose it is, has issues upgrades and downgrades of various races. It's interesting. It's good fodder for a podcast. For me, it falls into the category of one of those discussions in racing that's never going to help make me money, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of mental energy thinking about and arguing about it. But Mike, I know you have some points to make, and I'm sure that will provoke my brain to think about this matter a little more deeply than it has so far. So why don't you let us know what's happened and what you think about it?
Well, they upgraded, as you said, they upgraded some and they downgraded some. The most notable ones being the wood and the bluegrass were both downgraded from grade one to grade two. And then the Pennsylvania Derby, unsurprisingly, was upgraded to a grade one. What I've seen, there are very few people that think the Pennsylvania Derby shouldn't be a grade one. It's got the purse. It's had the quality of field. It's just been a fantastic race, especially in recent years. The controversy comes, of course, with the downgrade of the wood in the bluegrass, the wood in particular. And my two cents on this is the graded stakes committee, I think, should change the way they grade the races. They should lay out the criteria for what equals a grade one race. And they should say they are just like they do if a turf race is moved to the main track. They have the ability to downgrade that given race depending upon the quality and who actually runs in it. They should be allowed to do the same, so that if you have last year's Wood, which was only an 8-horse field, it was nearly won by a maiden. It was not won by anybody that any horse that ended up being a major player. They have the ability to go and downgrade that race retroactively based on who showed up. If they've got a grade two or grade one that this time of year shows up and it's essentially non-winners of two lifetime, they should be able to downgrade that race and downgrade it accordingly, not penalize future runners, because look, they have no idea whether we're going to see a 6-horse Wood or we're going to see a 12-horse Wood in 2017 with 6 graded stakes winners and 3 grade one winners. They have no idea.
I think it's hard just because, like, this grading system means such different things to different people. Like, I think, like, you're thinking of it as a handicapper. I think people in the breeding industry have a very different perspective than handicappers do when it comes to this stuff. I'll just say, in terms of the changes that you mentioned, they make sense. I mean, that since they moved that Pennsylvania Derby back, it's obviously become, like, the major stop for three-year-olds in the fall. Of course, at the expense of turning the once-great Jockey Club Gold Cup into, you know, just the same old older horses beating up on each other instead of what it used to be, pitting the top three-year-olds against the top older horses at that time of the year, which is a shame. But like with so many things in life, you get something, you give something. The idea of Triple Crown prep races not being grade ones, like as a handicapper, that just makes all the sense in the world to me. I mean, we've talked about the notion on the show of how I believe there are really, you know, there's grade ones and there's grade one pluses that really matter when I'm making my evaluations for something like the Eclipse Awards. And would I, as a handicapper, prefer to just have there not have to make that decision myself and just have the only grade ones be the grade one pluses? Sure, I'd love it. But I think it creates ripples and problems on the breeding industry side of things that the average horse player isn't necessarily thinking about or concerned with. JK, where do you stand on this issue of upgrading and downgrading races? Is it something you care about? Do you have an opinion?
I don't really care. I mean, you know, it's to me, the grading of races is for two things. The grading of races is for two things. It's for the breeders and it's for the record books. That's it. It doesn't really affect me in any other way. So that's all that really matters to me. I like to watch good races and watch good horses run in good races. And I don't care if it's a grade three or a grade one. You know, for instance, the Hollywood Derby this weekend, it is a grade one. But I wouldn't care if it was a grade three if all those same horses showed up. The reason I think they do show up for the grade one is because of the breeding implications in that race, especially when it comes to the female variety. I think it matters a lot to them. You hear the word black type all the time, and you hear it a lot when you're running around.
Explain what that is to listeners who might not know, Jacob.
Yeah, so a black type, I'm guessing the origination is when you actually look at a sales catalog.
Correct.
Horses mm-hmm. that have won graded stakes race, it shows up in black bold type. And so I'm assuming that when a horse's stakes placed and you look in their catalog, there's black type there. And I think that's why you hear people say, oh, we need to get some black type for this horse because it will help her sale, her resale value. It'll help her progeny and the progeny of her progeny and so on and so forth. And so I think that's why it's important.
That's right. You can get a filly or mare, a third in a grade three. That's black type on the catalog page. That's going to help the sales down the line. And a grade one is better than a grade two, et cetera, all the way down the line. Mike, anything to button up this conversation before I return us to tournament talk?
Well, the one thing I'll say on the breeding side is I would imagine if the breeders thought about it, then they might be behind my idea, because then it really does legitimize those races that are listed as grade ones. And when you can say, look, we're standing a true grade one stallion, not like the asterisk grade one that had only 5 horses entered against this one and it was, he got lucky, you know, which which most breeders anyway, when they send their mare, they can see through that anyway. They're going to know the difference between Arrogate's grade one in the Travers and say the grade one in, oh, I don't know, the Kentucky Jockey Club as a two-year-old. Most people realize that. They understand that. And I would think that the breeding industry, if they thought about it, they might be behind the idea.
All right. Let's go back to tournaments. Other big thing happening in tournaments this weekend, it is the launch of Public Handicapper's new contest, the Winter of Our Discontent Holiday Handicap, going to be happening this weekend. You can sign up now. It's free to play. You can pretty much join Public Handicapper in the middle of contest without much of a problem. There are also monthly and weekly prizes. But why not start at the very beginning? Go to publichandicapper.com and check it out and get involved. We love to use, wherever possible, the PH races on the show as a way of guiding us, especially on the Friday show. They provide the four races we're going to be talking about today. And let's start with one that Mike just mentioned, or maybe Jonathan just mentioned, the Hollywood Derby. It goes as the seventh race at Del Mar. I'm kind of going out of time order. Hopefully that's not messing you guys up too much, but I want to dispense with the West Coast and get back to the East Coast and those Claiming Crown races that are going to be part of the Conquer the Crown contest. Who wants to begin? Who has something to say about this Hollywood Derby?
Well, I'll say this. Regular listener Paul Romanelli, I don't know if Jonathan saw it because he only tweeted it to me. He said, I got even money. I know who Jonathan's picking.
Oh, I do too. I know who Jonathan's picking in here too. We might need a sound effect for this. I don't know. I don't know what it could be. But, just some sort of compilation of all the different times Jonathan has picked Richie Baltus horses on this podcast. I will say this though. He typically picks them shipping east. Now he's got one for a home game. So JK, are we on to you?
No, no. I'm actually gonna steal your thunder, Pete.
Oh,
Yeah. I am. I've said it before on the show, and I think we talked about it. I love Beach Patrol. I think that horse is really, really good. I am mad that I have not made money on Camelot Kitten being a full brother to my favorite, one of my favorite horses of all time, and so I'm a little bit annoyed by that. Bobby's Kitten. Watching that last race, I thought Annals of Time ran huge. And I don't feel like, you know, we got that question about what do you watch in replays. You know, I don't feel like he was ridden the last 100 yards of the race. He kind of got in tight and just didn't really run anymore and finished up really well. And one of the biggest things about this horse that has me leaning in this direction so hard is whatever figures you look at. And this is something that friend of the podcast and one of the best handicappers I've ever been with, so I don't want to take credit for it, Duke Matisse taught me, was – when you can see a horse that runs a number at two that fits with horses at three, that's a really strong handicapping angle. And if you look at Beach Patrol in Camelot Kitten, look at their figures that they ran as two-year-olds, and then look at the figure that Annals of Time ran as a two-year-old and what he has done since being – or what she's done – or what he's done, excuse me, what he's done since being back as a three-year-old – I think that this is one that Chad's been waiting to unleash and has obviously had some issues with that long break, needed the race two back, and then obviously had a little bit of the trouble facing his very, very talented stablemates. I think he's going to run huge, and I hope the world doesn't see it, and I hope that we can get this number, but it feels like he's going to come down a little bit.
Yeah, well, you did, in fact, steal my pick there. Annals of Time, to me, I feel like these 56 days off for him feel like they could do a lot more from now. I have no inside info. I tried actually to find somebody who'd seen how he'd been doing lately, and I failed miserably in that pursuit. But it just feels to me like the time off for a three-year-old could be the difference. He's only got a length to find, maybe less than that if you take Jonathan's trip note out of the Hill Prince. You know, this is a horse who I know is doing great heading into the last race, and I feel like this could be the right time to maybe get the other Chad Brown runner. Post doesn't make me super happy, but I'm thinking we're going to be compensated in price. I will probably save with both the other Chad Brown runners in here. I did do the little bit of research I did. I thought was funny. I was trying to look at was trying to do a little bit of handicapping based on the workout times listed from that November 27th day when all three of the Brown runners worked, and they worked within a little bit of time of each other. And I was talking to a friend who follows that barn pretty closely, and I said, you make anything of this, that the Annals of Time and Beach Patrol had the same workout time and Camelot Kitten was later? And he just said to me, look, don't waste your mental energy looking at Chad Brown workout times. He basically tells them to all go 48 or 49 and stay close together. And I said, well, they clearly did a good job that day. I don't even know for a fact if they worked together, but it just looked that way. Mike Hogan, what do you think of the Hollywood Derby?
Well, this is a fantastic race, and it's a wide open race. There's a lot of different ways you can go in here, and I think the Chad Brown runners, you mentioned all of them. I think they're logical and legitimate, and you know, Chad Brown certainly can win. He can win anywhere, and you have to take his horses seriously anytime he ships them. However, he generally doesn't win as much in Southern California, and they often get overbet. And I don't think any of them have a huge edge on any of the other runners. So I'm going to take a couple others. I'm not sure who I'm going to pick. One is probably a more likely winner, and then the other one's just going to be a very nice price. But I'm interested in a couple others shipping east, most notably number 8, Hayabusa 1 for Graham Motion, coming off of second start in North America, the debut at Keeneland after coming over from France, was really good. He looked kind of in deep water, and then at the top of the stretch changed leads and just found another gear. Really impressive race for him. I'm not worried about Florent Giroux riding Beach Patrol. Beach Patrol's a good horse. He's ridden him before. So, you know, obviously he's taking that mount over this one. But I think the sky's the limit for this horse, who could be a good thing in here, and we'll get some pace to run at. The other one that I really like, and one of my angles, and I wouldn't say angles, but one of the things I like to look for is a horse that is routinely bet heavily and maybe been a little bit of a disappointment in their career, and maybe coming off of a race where they lost and then are moving way up in class for a trainer who is really, really good. And the horse that fits that bill is number 9, Revved Up. Obviously has the pedigree, being out of Storm Flag Flying, to be any kind. Kind of nibbled at Graded Stakes Company in the Commonwealth Derby, where really just blew the start for a horse that's usually relatively forwardly placed. And then next out, maybe was going a little too far as the favorite and faded at Aqueduct. I like the cutback. Seems to be working well since. And Shug, for instance, when he sends him to Southern California, he does it very, very rarely. And aside from the Breeders' Cup, he's, I think, 2 for 3 in the last 5 years sending any horse to Southern California. So it's notable to me he takes a shot in here with a horse like Revved Up.
Yeah, it should be a big price and certainly has some live-looking things. I agree with that assessment as well.
I do just want to co-sign that I think Mike's pick of the Graham Motion horses is the second most likely. I think that horse is super live, and I could honestly say that I would be fine being alive to the third Chad Annals of Time and the Motion horse. I get it. Beach Patrol and Camelot Kitten make a lot of sense, but they're going to be on everyone else's tickets too. If you're on a little bit of a budget and you're trying to really, you know, like I've said, crush their souls, I'd be fine with just having those two horses and hope that I'm on the right Chad, or that the Motion's a freak and they're going to turn the tables on Beach Patrol, who's drawn the rail, and Camelot Kitten, who seems to always overachieve. And so that's an angle that I might be looking to play on Saturday.
Very interesting. All right, let's move back to Gulfstream. We've got 15 minutes. We've got 3 races. That should be plenty. We just can't go down any rabbit holes, and we'll be all right. The first Gulfstream race we're going to talk about is the 7th, the Claiming Crown Iron Horse. Excellent name for a Claiming Crown race, that's for sure. Mike Hogan, will keep it with you. Who'd you come up with in here?
I like a horse in here named Rich Daddy, who is 9-2 on the morning line, has been beaten by some of these foes in the past. But in all of his races where he's been bested, it was short fields, and he was maybe a little bit up against it. Last out, he was trying to close into a ridiculously slow pace. And the time before that, he actually made a middle move into a relatively faster or a much faster pace. And then flattened out. So I think he's got a little bit of muddied up form. The race two back where he failed as the favorite was on a wet track. I don't think he likes a wet track as much as he does a fast track. I'm assuming, I haven't looked at the weather, but I'm assuming is all is good for Saturday at Gulfstream. And I think
you never know when they have those Gulfstream contests, Mike. You
true.
Always, is that from past? No, but in all seriousness, it's the weather forecast is good for Saturday.
Good. And I think that helps a horse like Rich Daddy, who will get a little bit of pace to run at, will sit a good trip, and should be rolling late at a big price, or not a big price, but a square price.
Yeah, I'm hoping. Rich Daddy will be on my tickets, too. And, yeah, I think the 4-1, 5-1 range sounds about right. JK, what are you thinking in this one?
It's not very often that I give 20-1 shots, but there's a horse in here I like. Look, if you're playing Gulfstream, I'm going to need you to include every Jorge Navarro horse that you see. It's a playground down there, and I wouldn't try to get cute. So I would use the 14 here, good time had by all. But for me, I really want to have a little bit on the 11 Boca Scuttlebutt. Here's the thing. I looked at some of the old workout stuff that we have that I've seen from Gulfstream, and the horse has always worked well on the dirt, has had some really, really nice works on the dirt. They tried to get him on the dirt a couple times. Both times he didn't really run that great. Both of them having some gate trouble at the beginning of the race. At 20-1, I'm gonna go with the fact that he's in great form. He had his last win by 4 on the turf. If I can get this horse finishing late in a big field that should have a fast pace, and if he can just stand up on dirt, I think he's got a chance at a price. And he's one that I'll be using for sure. If I was playing in a $2 win place tournament, he'd be the one that I would use and hope that the 14 wins if he doesn't win, and that it wouldn't hurt me much in a tournament. So I like that horse, and he's one that I would definitely key underneath as well.
Do you think, Jonathan, the 14 will get the lead over the 1 Chepstow? Chepstow was another one I wanted to talk about in here. I liked having the rail and the speed and just guessing how the Gulfstream track is going to be playing. I agree. Maybe the two of them just set it up for something coming from out the back, but I was thinking Chepstow might be able to get it done wire to wire.
Like we talked about before, I can't remember which Breeders' Cup race it was that we talked about. Oh, it was the mile. When there's speed drawn outside, far inside, and in the middle, they're usually going to fly. I mean, to me, it's a break thing. The 1 and the 14 on pace figures kind of feel like they're similar horses. I guess I would go with Jose being aggressive from the 14. It's a short run to the first turn going a mile on the 16th at
yes.
Gulfstream, too. So I would think that Jose's got no option but to go on with it. And if I was riding a Jorge Navarro horse, I would go on with it, too, and think that they're not going to stop.
Yeah, his playground indeed. Just be very careful if you get into the sandbox that nothing happens to you. That's my only warning there. Let's move on to the 8th race, the Claiming Crown Canterbury, I think we're calling it. JK, we'll give you the honors on this one.
You know, it's one of those deals we talked about a bunch of times where we're switching arenas. The turf sprint seems to be changing at every place. It's just a different type of race wherever you're at. It's obviously different at Santa Anita, at Del Mar, at Aqueduct, at Saratoga, at Del Mar, at Belmont, down here as well. This is a quarter horse race to me almost at Gulfstream. I always find the 2 or 3 fastest horses, and I don't care if the horse is going to be 80-1. I want the horse that I project to be on the lead at least somewhere in my situation. For me, I felt like the 3 and the 5 made the most sense in terms of being on the lead. I'm a little bit concerned that the 5's pace figures aren't as fast as I would like to see, but the fact that the horse is going to be 20-1 is back to Carlo Vacareza or Carl. You know that can be something a little bit along the lines of a switch to Jorge Navarro. And so that's one horse that at a big price I'd be interested in. One that makes a little bit more sense, that leaves a little bit less to the imagination, would be American Sailor. The horse, the run at Laurel was pretty impressive, and that horse has some pretty good pace figures. And I would think that horse could be on the lead. I'm not going to argue with you about much in here. I don't want closers going 5 at Gulfstream on the turf.
I hear you. I couldn't resist though. My eye just kept going in this race to the 2 Mike Maker runners. I just I figure this event, the Claiming Crown races, to have his name on them. And I was very intrigued by both Creaky Cricket and Partly Mocha at the prices they're going to be. You might be right, JK. Maybe they're going to be, maybe they're just going to be too far back. But we don't know exactly what's going on. It's the beginning of the meet down there. For me, I'm going to play those two. Your idea about trying to get the best speed horse on the tickets, that's probably also a pretty darn good idea. And to me, that looks like it might be American Sailor, given the benefit of the inside post. Mainly, I'll be messing around with 6 and 7, with maybe a little bit of the 3. Mike Hogan, how do you see it?
I see it like you, Pete. I particularly like Partly Mocha, who came back not too long ago after a bit of an extended break. Seemed like didn't miss anything, and now Maker and the Ramseys are taking a shot in here, and obviously they do good work with claiming horses and turning them into stakes winners. I don't know if you guys saw my tweet. In the last 5 years, Mike Maker has claimed 25 horses that have gone on to win stakes races for him, which is just incredible. Partly Mocha, Creaky Cricket, both have a chance to do so in here. And I like that Partly Mocha has really run well, is not a stone closer, but, you know, we'll sit 3 or 4 lengths off early. There's some pace to run at, and has had success at 5 furlongs at Gulfstream. I think he's sitting on a big race, and, you know, but it's a pretty wide open run. And generally I'm with JK. You want speed in these races.
All right, let's move on to the Emerald. The Claiming Crown Emerald goes as the 11th race. I'll kick this one off. I like the looks of and the trip that I expected Class and Cash. Speaking of Class that we discussed at great length earlier, Class and Cash was going to get. Looks like a push-button horse to me who fits in terms of form and figures and is one that will be on my tickets. I also wanted to mention Riviere de Loop, who I think looks like might be the best closer in another. This, you know, going a bit longer here with an expected fast pace from my reading of it. I thought Riviera de Loop might be the best closer, and I wanted on some tickets. And I was also going to take a look. I don't know about the post. It's not exactly thrilling to me. Might make the trick a little difficult for number 14, Air Bueno, but another who was going to be on my tickets and I wanted to mention for our Twitter buddy, Chuck Simon. JK, what do you think?
Feels like they're going to fly in here. And one of the horses I couldn't get off was the 7 Dream Man for Gary Contessa. He claimed the horse for 25 at Saratoga this summer. Stretched the horse out too far. We you know, it's just that the trip at Saratoga was just too far. And then if you look at the races since then, the horse is always finishing. Had a little bit of trouble 2 back. Shuffled a little bit on the turn, but still came on well. He's one that I want to pick up the pieces. He just feels like he's probably a little bit better than some of these. And he's definitely the one that I want.
Love him for 3rd and 4th. Do you think there'll be enough pace to get up from as far back as he sort of projects to be?
Well, here's the thing is we're going to, it's 14 horses. There's going to be 14. So, I mean, the one is going to show speed. Your horse is going to show speed. The 11 feels like the 13 is going to show some speed. I mean, I could keep going. There's more.
There's more.
It feels like they're going to go on with it, especially in a big field. And you know, and remember, everyone, we're going back down south. Okay, this is not New York. There will be no strangling. There's going to be horses running forward, and I think that they're going to go on with it a little bit. The turf course seems to be in great shape, so I'm not really sure how it's going to play. You know, usually Gulfstream favors speed a little bit. But with these types of horses, I'm gonna bank on a collapse here, and I'm gonna bank on Dream Man picking them up.
Did you see that little Twitter video I sent around from the at the races in the UK clip of the jump race at the start where literally nobody wanted the lead? Did you watch that one, JK?
No, I didn't, but
I saw really that. Yeah.
It's funny. It makes, you know, New York, the colony on the turf, look like a bunch of Angel Corderos. It's great. Mike Hogan, what did you think of this?
This is so we talked a little bit about the rail settings at Gulfstream, and you want to be sure to check the late changes because sometimes they do move them. But however, you'll see throughout the day they move the rails. The 9th race, which is the filly version of this race, the Tiara, is the rail is set out at 72 feet. For this race, the 11th race, the rails go back to 0. Okay, so So they do that throughout. If they get rain or sometimes they change things, you want to look because sometimes they will move that. One of the notable ones was a race last meet last year where the pizza man was favored. They all of a sudden they moved the rails out in the late changes from zero to like 110. And there was no way he was able to rally from off the pace. That you absolutely want to look at. So in here, this is a setup with the rails at zero. It does make it somewhat even. It doesn't necessarily favor front runners. It gives the closers a fair chance. And there's a horse in here, Indian Guide, number six. First off the claim, so he qualifies. But prior to that, had been running against some good horses. And he'd been running in races where two back in the vid, I guess, is the name of the stakes race, the video. The rails were at 108 and ultimately just kind of tired. Prior to that, rails were at 120, kind of ran around, couldn't get to R.A. Bueno. Race before that, rails at 115. Race before that, rails at 72. You go back to May when the rails were at zero. He won easily by four on this course. He's a horse that likes the course. He's a horse that's just been claimed by a good claiming barn. He's going to be a big price. He's also seemingly working very well. The Clocker report is out. They've got positive workout notes on his last two works. And the one before that, first off the claim, he went 45-3 with in company with a horse named Saraguaro, I think is the name of the horse, who after that came back and ran a 9-plus buyer on dirt, losing to Mr. Jordan in the race where Mr. Jordan set the track record. So this is a horse that's seemingly in good form, has back class, likes the course, will get a good trip, and will be a very good price.
All right, good stuff. Good plug for the Clocker Report, too, Mike. Folks can go to drf.com to purchase that. Also, speaking of purchasing things, the Formulator deal is back for public handicapper players. Do you know the particulars of that off the top of your head, Mike? Don't worry if not.
Oh, I don't. Yeah. But even
I think it's $5. I'm pretty sure it's $5 for a daily unlimited. Does that sound possible? It's something. Go to publichandicapper.com. There'll be a banner ad about it. Sign up for the contest. It enables you for a fantastic discount. It's the one we ran at Saratoga. It might not be as good as what I said, but it's still pretty cool. If you're looking to test out Formulator, this is an absolutely great way to do it. That is all the time we have, gentlemen. No closing thoughts. You'll have to save them for Tuesday. I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin. I want to thank Mike Hogan. I want to thank all of you for listening. We're going to be back Tuesday at 11. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.